Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 60. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing something a bit different. I'm going to look at the history of a character and of a story which has been adapted into movies, television shows, stage plays, musicals, and all sorts of other things for over a century. And that particular character is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I'm going to look at the history of the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, go into a few of my favourites, and just take a look at the character, who is not what you think he is. So sit back and get the contact details out of the way, and I'll start the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey, how's everybody doing? Sorry, this one's just a little bit late. I kind of got into being slightly unwell. The reason for this is, of course, the fucking weather. Because tonight we are going to be getting hail, rain, storms, all sorts of tempests. And it wouldn't surprise me terribly much if the volcano that's a kilometre and a half away from here suddenly erupted, taking out every new house between my place and the volcanic crater. And by the way, there is a volcano a kilometre and a half away from my house. Hasn't erupted for 12,000 years, but that's neither one thing nor the other. Anyway, how are you? We've been kind of getting organized, which is nice. As I said before, I'm going to be doing a Martian Drive-In podcast recorded live at Continuum 11, the local science fiction convention, early in June. So I'm looking forward to doing that. I'll be doing it with Grant Watson and Sonia Marcon, so that's a lot of fun. Really hanging out to do that. And the week after that, Sal and I are going on a little bit of a vacay. We're going to go to Sydney to visit my sister and my nephew, my mum, and my brother-in-law, Gav. So we're going to spend a long weekend there. And then we're flying over to Perth for 10 days, right over to the other side of the country, over to Western Australia. I've been there a number of times, but Sal's never been there. So we're going to spend a little time there. I'm going to make sure I've got a few episodes up my sleeve by that time, which puts me under even more pressure. But what the hell, I'll get it done. And I'm looking forward to the break there. I have a sneaky suspicion I'll pick up some movies and books while I'm away. And that is never a bad thing for me. So, yes, and let's see, what else has been happening? Oh, yeah, what part of this tiredness and this slight sickness I've had is possibly to do with sleep apnea. So I'm going to get a sleep apnea test next Tuesday, which is an unusual little thing because what they do is they wire me up to a machine. So I go cyborg overnight. I go down in the afternoon to a medical center. They wire me up to a thing that's kind of a bit like, you know, that gear that Mickey Rourke wore in Iron Man 2 when he attacked the Monaco Grand Prix. It's kind of a little bit like that, but with a face mask. So I don't have the whips or anything, which is a bit of a shame. But there's a chest piece and there's a mask and all sorts of shit like that. And so I put that on overnight. Then I put it in a nice bag in the morning and I take it down to the medical center and they get all the data off it about why I'm not sleeping okay. And then I'll probably end up with a permanent face mask, a CPAP and all that kind of thing. But we'll see how we go. We've got to look after the health. And, yeah, so that's happening as well. So it is a kind of, for a wintry kind of time of year, it's getting kind of busy here. So anyway, decided to do something a little bit different for this podcast, and I'll talk about it more a little bit later. But I thought I'd look at Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I think it may have been triggered by seeing the Hulk in Age of Ultron. But I kind of liked the fact that there have been so many iterations of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and the fact that most of them get it exactly wrong. See, kind of in the same way that Frankenstein's monster is always treated wrong in Frankenstein movies, with the possible exception of maybe Penny Dreadful and Frankenstein the True Story and a few other bits and pieces. For the most part, Frankenstein's monster gets a very rough trot in the cinema. So I thought I'd take a look at Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and talk a little bit about Robert Louis Stevenson, the author of it, talk a little bit about how Mr. Hyde should look, and then go through a few of the high points of various adaptations of it on the screen, big and small. But before I do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about what I've been watching on the screen. And I've got my letterboxed up here. There we go. I saw the Michael Mann movie Black Hat, starring Chris Hemsworth. A little bit of a cyber thriller about Black Hat hackers and a whole bunch of running around and shooting at things and all that kind of stuff. Michael Mann was a good stylist in movies. I mean, he did some really great films. This isn't one of them. It's got an interesting premise. It's got some interesting locations, but it's shot really badly. And if you're a Michael Mann completist, of course you're going to see it. But unless you are, I really would steer away from it. It really doesn't have much to offer. And it doesn't give Chris Hemsworth, who is becoming an increasingly good actor, much to hang on to. So unless you like seeing Chris Hemsworth, which I know a lot of my female friends and gay friends like seeing, you'll avoid that one. And I did see a small movie, which was based, it was written by Neil LaBute, called Some Velvet Morning, which stars Stanley Tucci and Alice Eve. It's a two-hander set in one apartment, well, one kind of small house anyway. And it's about a woman, a young woman, who's had an older lover, who suddenly reappears at her doorstep with all of his luggage after a four-year hiatus. Now, I'm not going to say anything more about that, because there are a couple of twists and turns, and I kind of guessed the twist at the end on it, but it's a nice little character piece. It's a good little bit of acting, and it's got touches of Harold Pinter about it. It's got that kind of underlying tension. It's got a lot of sexual politics in it, and Stanley Tucci's character is an utter asshole. But I did enjoy watching that. It's a nice character piece. If you're into kind of cinema as storytelling, even though the sexual politics in it can be seen to some people to be a bit dubious, I enjoyed it a lot more than they did Black Hat, for instance. The other thing I've watched, which I'm going to talk about with a lady called Rebecca, who is taking over from Liz Travascus for a couple of weeks on ABC Local Radio Northern Territory, we've decided that we're going to do The Night of the Hunter, the Charles Laughton-directed movie with Robert Mitchum, Lillian Gish. Looking forward to doing that. It's a great movie. Revisiting it, I picked it up on Blu-ray for like $10 or something the other day, and thought I'd have to watch it, and sure enough, it's still good. It's got really, there are some tonal shifts in there. It goes from kind of almost documentary realism to magic realism to very impressionistic stuff. And it slides between them really well. It's the only movie that Charles Laughton ever directed, but he had done a lot of theatre direction. I think that held him in good stead as well. And some of the sets get almost impressionistic, and other sets are like documentary realistic, but the movie works, and I like Mitchum in the role he plays, and I like Lillian Gish in the role she plays. And I think the script is beautifully written by James Agee, but I'm not going to talk more about it because I'll take the gloss off the fact that I'm doing it in 2 days' time for the radio. So that's about all I've been watching on the big screen lately. I did go and see Age of Ultron again because, as I said, I'm going to be discussing it on a future Martian Drive-In podcast, and I wanted to give it two viewings to kind of get the gist of it, apart from all of the shooting things with beams and bashing up cities and all of that kind of crap. So anyway, I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about first Robert Louis Stevenson, the author of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and then talk a little bit about some of the iterations of it that have happened in the cinema and on the small screen.
your eyes. The first time you held me, summer filled my heart. The first kiss you gave me woke a sleeping dream, and I began to scheme how we would never part. But love has two faces, one false, one true. Which face are you? Shivered in your glance. Yes, last night your cold eyes started sudden fears. That moment my heart felt winter's icy kiss. Did I imagine
was Shirley Bassey with My Life Has Two Faces, which is actually from a 1968 Brian Forbes movie called Deadfall, which starred Michael Caine. And the music there is by John Barry. It doesn't have anything at all to do with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, except the music sounded right for the podcast, so I threw it in there. Okay, so Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You've got to start really with Robert Louis Stevenson. Didn't live very long, Stevenson. He was a world traveller. He was a poet. He was a writer of horror stories and adventure stories and all sorts of things like that. Lived to be 44. He only lived from 1850 to 1894. But he was mostly known as an essayist and a travel writer, apart from writing things like Treasure Island and Kidnapped and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Really interesting life in some ways, even though he was as sick as a dog for most of it. He really didn't get on well with the Scottish weather. He was born in Edinburgh and lived there for a part of his life, and the cold weather just simply didn't agree with him. So he travelled. He just didn't like things where he was, so he travelled around at a time when travel was a non-trivial pursuit. It wasn't just a matter of finding comfortable shoes, making sure you don't have a pocket knife in your pocket, and jumping on an aeroplane after maybe a body search. It wasn't anything like that. It was a major undertaking, and Stevenson did that in spite of his health issues. In fact, he met his wife while he was travelling. He met her in Europe. I'm going to find the bit about him meeting his wife just to show you the kind of lengths that Stevenson went to. His wife was called Fanny Vandergrift, and they met in Europe, and she actually went back to America with her then husband. She was married with a few kids. So she went back to America, and Stevenson, who was smitten and then wrote an essay about being in love for the first time when he was in his mid-30s, followed her to America. She was actually in California. She was around San Francisco. And so Stevenson took a ship to New York, then traveled across the country by train, and knocked the fuck out of his health. So he arrived in America, on the west coast of America, somewhere down near Monterey. And he was almost dying, basically, ill. And a bunch of ranchers around Monterey nursed him back to health. Who knows why, but they did. And Stevenson kind of found his way up to where Fanny was 5 years after they'd met. This all took 5 years for various reasons. And they got married in 1880. So they travelled north with her son Lloyd and had their honeymoon partly in the Napa Valley in California. They went to an abandoned mining camp up on the slopes of Mount St. Helens for the rest of it. And Stevenson wrote about this. So he was a character who had travelled enormously and he had a great breadth of knowledge about the world. So he and Fanny and Lloyd went back to Europe. They were trying to find a place of residence suitable for his health because he wasn't a well man at all. He spent his summers around Scotland and down in Dorset and Bournemouth. And it was actually while he was in Bournemouth and ill, he had a hemorrhage, which I don't have too much detail about what kind of hemorrhage, is where he wrote Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The story goes that he wrote a draft of it after having a dream and that Fanny woke him up from, and then either tore it up or burnt it, and then later on in a 3-day period rewrote the whole thing. Now, how much of this is true and how much is apocryphal is up for discussion. But there's also the rumour that he may have been, let's just say, pharmaceutically enhanced when he did the rewrite. Some say he was using cocaine. Some say he was using ergot, which is a mold derivative from which we got another substance well known in literary circles, LSD. So we don't know whether he was on cocaine, we don't know whether he was on a hallucinogen, we don't know whether he was just ill. So he wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde while either drug-fucked or in quite an unwell state. So he lived a number of years after that. He and his wife and family moved to Samoa in the Pacific, and he died there of a brain hemorrhage at the age of 44. So if you're trying to imagine what Robert Louis Stevenson looked like, if you wanted to cast him and you were going back to, say, the 1960s or early 1970s, the guy you'd probably cast to play Robert Louis Stevenson would be a young Donald Sutherland. He's got that kind of lean, slightly crazy, buggy-eyed look about him. He had a big mustache and skinny and not a well-looking person at all. So Stevenson wrote this story, and it's not the story that most people know. There's a few things about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that really have slid under the radar, and I can tell you some of the reasons why as well. For a start, Dr. Jekyll is a man of 50, and Mr. Hyde is a much younger man. The whole story, which is a novella length, is set up as a mystery. We know that Dr. Jekyll, and of course this is a spoiler for anybody who doesn't know anything about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and of course for the people who read it at the time in 1886 when it was written. There's a mystery of what's the relationship between these two men, the upright and well-regarded doctor and the much shorter and younger Mr. Hyde. And a friend of Dr. Jekyll's called Utterson is the person who does the investigation on this and ultimately solves the mystery of who Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were. People reading at the time didn't have any history of this kind of duality kind of thing, the good side, bad side, none of that kind of stuff. So it was very, very popular tale at the time. One of the most successful ones that Stevenson did, and of course its subsequent history has shown that it's definitely a story that has a lot of legs to it. So that's the thing. Dr. Jekyll, much older, much taller. Mr. Hyde, shorter and younger. And they don't say he's particularly ugly either. They just say that he's kind of, you know, wild, random, angry, poor impulse control, horny, nasty, all of that, sadistic. Though undoubtedly Stevenson phrased them better than I just did then. Here's where the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde changes. A year after it was written, in 1887, a stage play opened in Boston. A guy called Thomas Russell Sullivan adapted Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for the stage. It was a very serious theatrical rendering, and it toured England and ran for 20 years. And the characters of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were played by the same actor, a guy called Richard Mansfield, who played the role right up until his death. So Jekyll and Hyde are played by the same actor, and there's an on-screen transformation or on-stage transformation and all that kind of thing, which shocked and horrified the punters at the time. And that's where we got the conceit of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde being more or less the same age and more or less the same height. Because to do this role, which is got to be a great role for an actor, you get to play an upright citizen and you get to play a horny, lecherous monster all in the one stage play. So it's got to be attractive to a certain form of actor, particularly someone like Richard Mansfield. So Jekyll and Hyde were the same age, same height, same build as well. It's a necessity based on the stage thing. Now, there was a 1907 adaptation, again by Thomas Russell Sullivan, who reworked the plot to centre around a domestic love interest. In 1900, there was another play in four acts. It was an unproduced adaptation by a guy called Marshall Schwab and Vance Thompson. There were various stage adaptations in 1991. And in 1998, there was a musical version, which was kind of sort of successful. There was a new theatrical adaptation in 2009, 2010, 2012, 2013 as well, in various parts of the world. And one of the 2013 versions was called Flipping the Bird. It was at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And the twist was that Dr. Jekyll was a woman who transformed into Edward Hyde as part of her desire to defy social boundaries. Utterson, the lawyer friend, served as a lover and lawyer while she claimed Hyde is her deformed nephew before admitting the truth. Now, that'd be an interesting adaptation. You can see the way that people kind of reinvent the character and the story, the characters and the story for their own means. And then we get into film. There wasn't a film version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde until 1908, when William L. Selig did an adaptation. There was a Danish version in 1910. What was I going to say, 2010? In 1910, there was a Danish version. And again, both of these films, there's no existing copies of them left. There was a 1912 adaptation of the William Mansfield stage performance. 1913, 1914, 1920, there was a silent version, which is one of the more famous ones, starring John Barrymore, which pretty much followed the 1887 Sullivan version, and it also borrowed a little bit from The Picture of Dorian Gray. I'm reading a lot of this stuff from Wikipedia. I haven't had time to do a lot of research. There was a 1920 movie called De Janus Kopf, the Janus Head, being Janus, the two-faced god of Roman mythology, directed by Murnau, which would be an interesting one to see. Unfortunately, that film was lost as well. And then we get to the two interesting versions, which were the first versions of the movie I ever saw. And the first one is the 1931 pre-code American sound version done in Hollywood of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, starring Frederick March.
What you are about to see is a secret you are sworn not to reveal. Now, you who have sneered at the miracles of science, you who have denied the power of man to look into his own soul, you who have derided your superiors, look! Look!
This version was directed by Reuben Mamoulian and also starred Miriam Hopkins as a bar singer called Ivy Pearson, who is basically the squeeze of Mr. Hyde. And because this is a pre-code American movie, there's a lot of lechery and Ivy wearing a skimpy lingerie and things like that. So it's a kind of earthier version of the story than the one 10 years later, which was made by MGM in 1941. But this version's really kind of gutsy and earthy and a little bit surprising for the era. When it was re-released in 1936, the code made them take 8 minutes out of the film so it could be distributed into the theatres and not scare the horses. But fortunately, the VHS and DVD releases restored that footage, so we've got a bit of a win there. We don't have a culliard version of that particular movie now. We've got the full version, which is terrific. The really big thing, and the thing that really made the movie interesting, was Wally Westmore's makeup for Hyde. Now, again, I'm looking at Wikipedia here. He did make him very simian and hairy with big canine teeth and big teeth in general. And there's a very clever transformation sequence, which the film was in black and white, of course, so it was done with the makeup being applied in contrasting colours, and with a series of coloured filters that match the makeup were put in front of the camera and were gradually removed from the in front of the lens so that various makeup was visible. And so the transformation, to some extent, was done in camera, and that was considered shocking and horrible at the time. It's a nice little conceit there. I like the way it's done. And of course, this then led on to other transformation sequences in movies in the middle part of the 20th century, including The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr., for instance. There was a lot of this was kind of groundbreaking technology at the time for doing these things. And for many years, they never said how they did it. It was only when Reuben Mamilian did an interview for a book called The Celluloid Muse, which I've got a copy of. Just trying to see if I can spot it on the shelves. I do have a copy of that, where he revealed how the transformation was done. It was one of those big mysteries. It wasn't like now where you get a whole bunch of extras that tell you how the magic's done. This one was kept secret for decades. So we've got that version with Frederick March, a well-known character actor at the time, and Miriam Hopkins, and it's a really good version too. Then we move on to the 1941 version MGM did with Spencer Tracy and Ingrid Bergman.
Good and evil are so close as to be chained together in the soul. Man is not truly one, but two. Now, supposing we could break that chain, separate those two selves, free the good in man and let it go on to its higher destiny, and segregate the bad. Let it destroy itself in its own degradation.
Good heavens.
Why, Dr. Jekyll?
Hopelessly insane.
This is pure balderdash.
You're dealing with things it would be better not to mention for your own sake. There might be trouble.
Did you think that Dr. Jekyll was falling in love with you? You with your cheap little dreams? Or did you think as you looked at him that perhaps in his eyes you saw a bit of me, Hyde? Was that it?
No.
It's interesting, isn't it?
This version, directed by Victor Fleming, was less successful than the version 10 years ago, partly because the Hays Code watered things down, and partly because Spencer Tracy was miscast in it. He didn't really see himself playing an English doctor, and he tried to back out at one stage, and he was quite unhappy with his acting. In fact, he was so unhappy that Somerset Maugham came onto set, the writer Somerset Maugham came onto set, and watched Spencer Tracy filming a scene, and then whispered to the director, which one is he being now, Jekyll or Hyde? So it's not that successful. I mean, the movie itself is interesting. There's a bit of Freudian symbolism in there, which makes it kind of fun in some ways. It's got a good cast. Ingrid Bergman is good as the bad girl, and Lana Turner's playing the good girl. In fact, originally they were going to do it the other way around, but Ingrid Bergman wanted to get away from her nicey-nice reputation and do it. She wasn't entirely happy with the results, but mostly, if you want to lay blame anywhere, it's the fact that Tracy was miscast, didn't like the role particularly, and also that the censorship at the times didn't allow the film to really go places where it essentially needed to go in order to tell the story in the way that the story deserved to be told. For instance, Ivy, the character who in the 1931 version was fairly obviously a prostitute, it was heavily emphasised that she was a barmaid in this version. It's one of those censorship kind of things. It's a bit like in Ministry of Fear, where the heroine has to be a seamstress rather than a bar girl or a prostitute. That kind of stupid, unnecessary censorship that the Hays Code was very much known for. New York Times describes Spencer Tracy in this one. I'm just reading from IMDb here. which is really funny saying, not so much evil incarnate as ham rampant, more ludicrous than dreadful. And Tracy agreed to that, though it's a bit of a shame because Spencer Tracy's real life had Jekyll and Hyde aspects to it. Of course, he was a very well-regarded actor and a very famous actor, but he always underestimated his own talents. And he did have a penchant for going out on very long and very self-destructive alcoholic binges. So you'd think there was a character with which he could empathise a bit, but maybe he was a little too close to the bone for Spencer Tracy. And maybe he thought that dressing up in wigs and makeup was a bit silly. But whatever the reason, he really didn't like the movie. I kind of like it. I've seen it a few years ago, and I didn't mind it at all. I don't think it's the best adaptation of the story. I think the 1931 version is really a little more interesting. There are other versions that are just as interesting. But I actually got this one on a disc, a double disc, with the 1931 version, which is kind of nice because you can compare and contrast the two, which is what I always like doing when they're just a decade apart, but in a very different censorship environment. I mean, seeing a comparison between a pre and a postcode film makes you want to go and punch a censor. There's no two ways about it. You really want to go and just hit him in the face. It's unnecessary. It was stupid. It was playing to the worst conceits of American society at the time, and it really did retard the American film industry for a very, very, very long time. And when I say retard, I don't mean in a financial sense at all. What I mean is it retarded them telling adult stories in an adult manner for a very long time. I probably should clarify that. But I've been having some more thoughts overnight, and I've recorded this in little chunks and bits, regarding Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I've worked it out. Take a look at a map of Edinburgh and Glasgow. Dr. Jekyll is Edinburgh. Mr. Hyde is Glasgow. They're only down the road from each other. I've driven through both of them. And, one's a very kind of ordered and polite and upright kind of town, or at least it was in those days. And the other is Darwinian cesspit. But I like both of them. I mean, I do like both of the places. But, yeah, there is that kind of duality in Scotland, which is very much reflected in the duality of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And the other thing too, I don't know whether I mentioned it earlier, and if I'm repeating myself, I apologise. One of the things about Robert Louis Stevenson is the fact that he used to frequent brothels as a young man and was known to imbibe in alcohol and things like that, and felt a lot of guilt about it. Not religious guilt, of course, but atheist guilt, because he was a self-proclaimed atheist before it was popular to be one. And he was aware of the fact that everybody has that kind of wild and rambunctious side, which his society just wouldn't let him be. But anyway, there wasn't that much Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde stuff during World War II, but there were cartoons after World War II. And I'll talk about three of them, which pretty much everybody's seen, but we'll just kind of name-check them to be slightly completist about this. In 1947, we got the MGM Tom and Jerry cartoon.
There's that concoction.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Mouse.
That failing of mine.
It's actually available online for free if you know where to look. And it's a pretty simple story.
I'm so ashamed.
You know, Jerry keeps stealing Tom's saucer of milk. So Tom decides to mothballs, acid, bleach, ammonia, shoe white, bug powder, and all sorts of other bits and pieces. So he mixes that up and thinking he's going to poison Jerry the Mouse, but it turns out it turns him into basically a steroid mutant. So it's a super soldier serum rather than a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of thing, in a sense. And Jerry the Mouse becomes bigger and muscular and aggressive. So yeah, it's an anabolic steroid basically made out of mothballs and ammonia. Then they have the usual reverses where this formula reverses itself just as Jerry gets the upper hand and all that kind of stuff. So it plays out pretty much the standard Tom and Jerry cartoon way, with Tom the cat getting the second best of it. Then in 1955, you've got the first of two Warner Brothers cartoons that address this kind of thing, which is Hyde and Hare, H-A-R-E, which is a Bugs Bunny cartoon where Bugs Bunny gets adopted from living in a park in the hole in the ground by Dr. Jekyll, and it's got some really nice little bits of Mel Blanc stuff like this.
Oh, my. There's that concoction. Oh, that failing of mine. No, no. I won't weaken. Oh, I'm so ashamed.
Then, of course, we've got the third one of them, which is Hide and Go Tweet 1960, which was a Sylvester the Pussycat slash Tweety Bird bit joint, which did pretty much the same thing as the earlier Bugs Bunny one. Not too much different there. But, yeah, again, it shows that the pop culture had Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde well in its sights. And but up until the late 1950s from the 1941 version, there wasn't really much done with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, even though it was well in the public domain by then. People were seeing other kinds of movies, but then the 1950s came along, and you got the drive-in horror movies, and it was perfect and ripe time for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde to get another go. And in 1957, there was a low-budget John Agar movie called The Daughter of Dr. Jekyll.
Daughter of Dr. Jekyll, yearning for love and discovering on the eve of her marriage the monstrous inheritance that was her birthright of fear.
Oh, I still shudder when I recall that face, like some perverted mask of evil out of a legend of horror.
Then you saw him, Miss Hyde?
Once, at the very last. Just before the mob caught him, they almost tore him to pieces. The villagers broke into this tomb and drove a stake through his heart.
Daughter of Dr. Jekyll, terrified that she become the disfigured thing that was her father, a vampire drawing sustenance from bestiality.
Got to get a stake and drive it through my heart and bury me beside my father.
Well, do it! Do I have to kill myself? If you love me, please kill me!
So you can pretty much tell what the movie's supposed to be there. Gloria Talbot plays the daughter of Dr. Jekyll. And I'm reading from Wikipedia here. There's a nice little bit by Andrew Saras, the American film critic. It says, the film has a scenario so atrocious that it takes 40 minutes to establish that the daughter of Dr. Jekyll is indeed the daughter of Dr. Jekyll. And somebody else suggested that, a guy called Gary Don Rhodes, suggested that the film may be read as a critically significant text within the melodramatic crisis of female identity theatre of the 1950s. He describes the film as an identity quest set in a dark fairy tale. I'm going to have to view this movie now. I'm going to have to find a copy of The Daughter of Dr. Jekyll just for the fun of watching it. I haven't had a chance to yet. I'm not that fond of John Agar movies because as an actor he makes a very good fence post. But I'm going to have to now. I'm just going to have to go there. Though that one was preceded, and I've only just found this out by looking up The Daughter of Dr. Jekyll. I'm doing the research for this on the hop in a lot of ways. There was a movie called The Son of Dr. Jekyll in 1951, which starred Louis Hayward, and pretty much follows a not dissimilar thing. Film begins with a prologue in 1860 where Mr. Hyde is chased down on the streets of London after murdering his wife in their Soho flat. He escapes to the house of Dr. Jekyll, blah, 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 blah. So, I'm gonna have to do a lot more research on this and check out a lot more of these really kind of low-budget Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde movies, because the more I look at them, the more interesting they become. So, Dr. Jekyll basically had a son and a daughter. So, what do you know? How come it's never the son of Mr. Hyde? How come it's always like the son and daughter of Dr. Jekyll? Doesn't Mr. Hyde get some kind of paternity rights there? But, of course, in 1960, the UK had to get involved because it was at that peak of Hammer horror mania, which had come about after The Mummy, their version of Dracula, and of course Curse of Frankenstein came out. And then that brings us to The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, which indeed was a Hammer horror film. Interesting cast in some ways. It's directed by Terence Fisher, who directed some of the more famous earlier Hammer horror films. And it stars Paul Massey as Dr. Jekyll and, oddly enough, Mr. Hyde. Dawn Adams and Christopher Lee, which is a kind of a bit of a waste of Christopher Lee playing the kind of friend. I think Christopher Lee would have been more interesting as Dr. Jekyll. And indeed, he does that a while later. In 1971, there's a kind of psychological version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde called I, Monster, which starred Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. And I've watched that one about 2 years ago, and that one was kind of interesting. It actually borrowed a lot of some dialogue from the original story, which was a kind of unique thing in the adaptations of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that they actually used Robert Louis Stevenson's words. But to get back to Dr. Jekyll and the Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, sorry. The conceit, of course, in this one is that Dr. Jekyll is kind of older and uglier, and Mr. Hyde is younger and more handsome, but murderous and lecherous, all that kind of thing. So it's kind of stayed more closely in some ways to the original Robert Louis Stevenson story, though, of course, Mr. Hyde is not shorter, and he is younger, but he's not shorter than Dr. Jekyll. So they've stayed with that conceit, which is consistent through almost every adaptation that I can find of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in that the same actor plays both roles. It's not even considered to have different actors playing the roles. Though, of course, there is one exception to that, and I'll talk about that in not too long from now. But the downside of The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll is Paul Massey, the actor who plays Jekyll and Hyde, he's not that interesting on the screen for some reason. I don't know whether the direction didn't give him what he needed, whether he was just not up for it, but I didn't really find him very convincing as either character for that matter. So that of course wasn't as successful as the previous Hammer horror films have been. But in 1960 as well, Hammer had another go at Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and this one was quite influential. And that was a movie starring Bernard Breslau called The Ugly Duckling. And this one you can't find anywhere. It's almost a lost film in some ways. I'm sure there are prints of it somewhere, but it really is a difficult one to find. Now, this conceit, which is one which was pinched 4 years later by a more famous person. I'll just paraphrase the Wikipedia on this, because if anybody's got a copy of this, or if anybody can steer me in the direction of a copy of this, I'd really like to watch it and possibly review it for the podcast, because I can't seem to find it anywhere. The plot is from Wikipedia. Henry Jekyll is a bungling, awkward and socially inept buffoon who works in his uncle's pharmacy. One day he discovers an old formula created by his uncle, which claims to turn a man of timid disposition into a bold, fearless dragon. He mixes up the formula, takes one drink, and transforms into a suave, dashing, and self-confident Teddy Hyde. Teddy immediately becomes a darling of society and a big hit with the ladies, but he's also a criminal. He's a master criminal and recruits a gang of expert crooks to join him in carrying out a series of daring and ambitious jewelry robberies. Now, this one I want to see, because I've seen it before. I saw it a long time ago, before most people listening to this were born. But I do want to see it again. I'll probably be disappointed, because it won't be as good as the hype that I've built up in my own mind about it, but it's worth checking out, and it's got a good cast too. Bernard Breslau, of course, playing Henry Jekyll. His uncle is played by John Pertwee, who went on to do some television stuff later on. Reginald Beckwith is in it. Michael Ripper's in it as well. And, and Joe Lossany's orchestra. So that's kind of cool. It wasn't a box office success. Apparently, it was made for a budget of 110,000 quid and lost 20,000 quid on the deal. But nonetheless, I'd like to see this film, because it's one of those Hammer films that people just haven't seen, which is a little bit of a shame, because I like Bernard Breslau as an actor. He did a lot of stage work. He was quite a well-regarded character actor on stage, not as in the comedy stuff you saw him for in the Carry On films, but as a serious character actor. And of course, he played the Cyclops in that piece of shit movie that a lot of people seem to like, Krull from 1983. I don't know why people like that film. I've tried to rewatch it once a few years ago, and I just found it unbearable to watch, except for Bernard Breslau with his one eye. But anyway, if anybody's got a copy of The Ugly Duckling they want to share, or if they can steer me in the direction of one, really like to get one. It's probably one of my favourite adaptations of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, because I saw it early and I really did like it. The movie that, of course, that pinched the whole plotline from The Ugly Duckling was this one.
Well, we're just about ready, Jennifer.
You might be ready, Julius, but if I were you, I'd think about it.
We don't care if you blab about the beginning of this picture, nor do we care if you give away the ending, but we do care if you reveal the middle. In fact, Jerry Lewis urges you to see this picture from the beginning on penalty of losing your popcorn privileges. One thing we will tell you is that Jerry plays the part of an eccentric chemistry professor who invents the greatest new drink since Dracula discovered the Bloody Mary. One sip and he turns into... Ah, that would be telling. And even those who know aren't telling.
Yep, so we've got the Nutty Professor, and the person he turns into, Buddy Love, was obviously a little bit of a spoiler that didn't get given away in the trailer, which is kind of odd. But it does show that people at the time didn't have the media coverage that we do now, the media saturation. Otherwise, all of those spoilers would have been available on the web had it existed in 1963. Then, of course, you can always look at... The Nutty Professor, the version done much, much later by Eddie Murphy, where it was turned into a whole series of Your Mama and Fat jokes. But I did try to watch that version of the Nutty Professor once, and once was enough. I really didn't find it very funny. I like the Nutty Professor. I do think there's a whole bunch of very funny conceits in the Nutty Professor. There's the hangover sequence. There's Stella Stevens, who was ravishing and also a good, like, comedic actress in various roles. Not particularly in that one, because she was there basically as eye candy. But she does get a couple of little bits and pieces in there. And people have said that Buddy Love is a pastiche on Dean Martin, but I think he's more a pastiche on Frank Sinatra. Having a look at the character of the two men, Buddy Love comes across very much more like a Sinatra character. He's got the violence, he's got the conceit, he's got the nastiness that Sinatra himself had. But then, of course, we get into slightly more serious ones. As I said, there's I, Monster in 1971. And then there is, in 1971, this very same year... Oh, before I do those, there was a 1967 Indian movie called Karutha Rathrikal, Dark Nights, a thriller. It was the first science fiction film in the Malayalam language, which was kind of cool. Be interesting to see that one as well. But in 1971 also... Hammer had another go at the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde subgenre with a very different interpretation, which was very much kind of based on the new freedom of showing things on the screen.
Everyone knows there are two sides to the infamous Dr. Jekyll. By day, the man. By night, the monster.
Put a woman in your life. A good woman, and one day you'll wake up and you'll see a changed man.
Now, Hammer believe you too are ready for a change, an absolutely complete change.
This is the testament of Dr. Henry Jekyll. Male. Male. Male.
It's Hyde, isn't it? How is your brother?
He hasn't been himself of late.
This is the new Dr. Jekyll, the most evil woman you'll ever see. This is the sensuous Sister Hyde, the most evil man you'll ever meet.
Stay away from her. She means you great harm.
Why?
I just feel it, that's all.
Dr. Jekyll, Sister Hyde. Man or woman? Or both? In this film, you will actually see the sinister Dr. Jekyll change in mind and body into the totally evil Sister Hyde.
It is I who exist, Dr. Jekyll, not you. It is I who will be rid of you. Rid of you! Rid of you!
Hammer invites you to share the agony of a man whose body is possessed by a strange passion to murder and beyond.
They must be female, no more than 20 years old.
There will be a different kind of victim tonight. And then the tug of war will be ended between us. Fascinating situation, don't you think? It'll be interesting to see who wins.
Yep, it was the 1971 movie starring Martine Beswick and Ralph Bates, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, which is the gender-bending version of the story. And I like this adaptation. It really is good. It does kind of go into gender and identity in a 1971 kind of way, even though Sister Hyde is kind of, well, murderous. She also is attracted to men, which brings in a whole new aspect to the character, which is kind of cool and very interesting as well. I think it's one of the era, of the 1970s. It's one of the more interesting Hammer films from that time for that reason, because it does get into a lot of conversations that we're having now about gender, about identity, about sexuality and things like that. Even though it is in a schlocky horror context, I think still it's really interesting that they actually went there and did that and kind of explored that in a very kind of rudimentary 1970s fashion. If you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth seeing. It really is worth your time. Now, in 1973, we come to an even more interesting, in some ways, version. A US TV movie was made of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as a musical starring Kirk Douglas, Michael Redgrave, Stanley Holloway, and Donald Pleasance as Fred Smudge. Now, the interesting thing about this isn't so much that it's a musical adaptation. There have been a couple of them, one fairly recently. But this is Donald Pleasance singing a song about being Fred Smudge the Thief.
If there's anything that you need, call me. If there's anything I can do, say the word. I'm the type who can be trusted, whose lips are always sealed. Service is me profession and I'm an expert in me field. So if there's anything in your life lacking, whatever your lordship wants, I'm your man. I've a most impressive record, not many can make this claim. 22 times arrested, not a conviction to me name. So if there's something you haven't got, name it. Whatever the items are, itemize. Maybe it's a pair of dice whose corners are round. Maybe it's the press what makes a counterfeit pound. It may be on the up and up or under some ground. But if Smudge can't find it, it can't be found.
You can find that on YouTube in a whole bunch of different parts. The VHS copy of it's not fantastic, but it really is a weird musical. Lionel Bart wrote the musical Oliver, based on Oliver Twist, of course, which became very successful in the late 1960s. This one is, you've got to see it to believe it bad. Apart from singing and dancing Donald Pleasance, it does have singing and dancing insane people in a lunatic asylum. A bedlam kind of lunatic asylum, which is one of them bashing his head against a wall and all sorts of things like that. It's incredibly ill-considered. And Kirk Douglas at times seems to be in on the conceit. At other times he's taking it very seriously and taking himself very seriously. Check it out if you want to, but it really is one of the more off-the-wall adaptations of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Then, of course, we've got the 1976 movie, right on the arse end of the blaxploitation craze. called Dr. Black, Mr. Hyde, starring Bernie Casey and Rosalind Cash. Haven't seen that one for a while, but again, there was a blaxploitation movie for everything. There was Blackenstein, there was Blackula. Why not Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde? And yeah, that one is another one too that I might want to check out at some stage. Most of the later adaptations of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were kind of weird. There were a lot of television adaptations. There was a memorable miniseries done with Michael Caine starring as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which had a very nasty little coda at the end of it. If you can find a copy of that, you'll know what I mean. There was a campy satire in 1982 called Jekyll and Hyde Together Again. There was a 1981 TV adaptation with David Hemmings in the dual role. And there was a Russian adaptation in 1985. There was an Australian telemovie animated version in 1986, which I haven't even heard about. And then, of course, in 1989, there was a low-budget US one, Edge of Sanity, with Anthony Perkins as Jekyll and Hyde. And basically, he turns into Mr. Hyde because of synthetic cocaine, which is a very 1980s way of doing it, if you ask me. There was a 1995 movie, Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde, in which a descendant of Dr. Jekyll created a variant of his ancestor's potion that turns him into a woman. Again, this is probably just somebody having another go at the Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde kind of thing. Then, of course, there's the 1996 version, Mary Riley, starring Julia Roberts and John Malkovich. And it was based on a novel of the same name by Valerie Martin. It's kind of a bit weird. It's a bit like doing... basically, it concentrates on the housekeeper of Dr. Jekyll rather than Dr. Jekyll himself, which is really weird. It's like making a Sherlock Holmes movie that concentrates on Mrs. Hudson. I really didn't enjoy that one at all the one time I saw it. And there was a 2002 UK TV adaptation with John Hannah playing both roles, which is kind of cool. Then, of course, we get into things like there's a Canadian version in 2006, a TV adaptation in 2008 with Doug Ray Scott, Tom Skerritt, and a 2015 one, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was Mickey Rooney was in it in his final role. I haven't seen that one yet as well. So just to round things up and to finish things off, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, of course, the ultimate iteration of it, I suppose, in some ways, would be the Hulk. First Hulk in 2003, then The Incredible Hulk, then, of course, the Avengers movies. That duality of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as it's popularly perceived, remembering, of course, that Mr. Hyde is a younger, better-looking and shorter version of Dr. Jekyll. The popularly held public perception of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde does get its ultimate iteration in Bruce Banner / The Hulk, where the Hulk is an enormous, powerful ego and id unleashed. And you get aspects of Beauty and the Beast, of course, in the second Avengers movie with that as well. So it's one of those characters that has a couple of different origins. But just to round things up, I think Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde has had a great and honourable movie history. It's one of those things that gives an actor a chance to strut their stuff more than some other roles do. And, of course, that's attractive to actors to be able to kind of stretch themselves and to play two different roles in one movie or one play or one TV adaptation is a very attractive thing. It's a kind of gymnastic or a marathon exercise for an actor in a lot of ways. And we like them too. The audience really does like them. The makeup and costuming and the technology that we use to show the transformations, of course, has got a lot better. I haven't seen any really good CGI versions of it, apart from, of course, the Hulk. But I'm sure that there are going to be some if there aren't already, and that as the technology of filmmaking progresses, we're going to see a lot more iterations of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde well into the future. It's not going away anytime soon. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. I'm going to do the credits, of course. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to the patreon.com/paleocinema page and make a micro payment to help cover the costs of the podcast. I'm going to be back in a week with another Martian Drive-In podcast, where I'm going to hit a couple of the movies that the Patreon subscribers have asked me to do. And also this weekend I'm releasing a Paleo Cinema podcast. So in the meantime, look after yourselves, keep watching the skies, and don't drink any potions you don't know what's in. Bye. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. And the way to get on the credits is to donate to the podcast via patreon.com/paleocinema. Okay, we have Tim the Mystery Credit. I haven't got the credit from Tim yet. We have Tammy the Donut Wrangler. Paul the Special Makeup Effects Director. Mark the Second Unit Director. Alyssa the Location Scout. Tansy the Foley Artist. Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress. Christopher the Gaffer. Chris the Camera Operator. And we'll wait for the big crescendo in the music, which is Alberato del Gracioso by Ravel. Julia, the casting director. Elaine, the scientific advisor. Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler. Armin, the key grip. Jan, the dialect coach. Morris, the music director. Gary, the prop master. Claire, the script doctor. Grant, the technicolor consultant. Ian, the caterer. Sarah, the special effects technician. And Tom, the focus puller. Thank you very much to all of the people who support the podcast via the Patreon campaign. I'll catch you guys later.